Good morning. It's 9 a.m. on Monday morning and time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial perspective. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Today, we offer the Mole's take on a couple of issues currently dominating the news: the erosion of democratic rights and Simone Biles, the Olympian who decided that enough was enough. For those who like to learn about the world through fiction, we have a novel about Kurdistan to talk about. Lastly, we'll take a look back at some stunning photography of Portland in resistance. Today, the Old Mole kicks off our photographic retrospective, 30 years in the streets of Portland, the activist photography of Betty Lee. At the end of the show today, I'll be talking with Betty about her photography. We'll be posting her images every week on the KBOO webpage, along with her reflections. Maybe you'll even see yourself in one of those images. You can also view her vast collection of photos by visiting the Old Mole Facebook page. Before we get on with the show, I want to remind listeners that KBOO is a listener-supported community radio station without any corporate sponsors. If you would like to help keep us on the air, please go to kboo.fm and click on the red donate button. And thanks to all of those folks out there who have already given generously to support community radio. First on our show today, we have Bill Resnick in conversation with Nancy Rosenblum about the everyday manifestations of democracy. Bill and Nancy make the case that neighbors who look out for each other are basic to a functioning democracy, but that neighborhood social cohesion is also vulnerable to broader social currents of racism, sexism, and all the other isms that drive us apart. So, what exactly does being a good neighbor have to do with democracy? Well, take a listen.
Hi, Nancy Rosenblum. Welcome to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
Nancy Rosenblum is a teacher. She was named a distinguished professor at Harvard's School of Government. She first taught and wrote political theory, but in mid-career, she pivoted to writing about the real world of American politics. Just last year, she published a book, A Lot of People Are Saying. You may recognize that, one of Donald Trump's most absurd contentions. A lot of people are saying, and then colon, the new conspiracism and the assault on democracy. And in 2016, she authored the book Good Neighbors, The Democracy of Everyday Life. That's our subject today, democracy in everyday life. So, Nancy Rosenblum, why did you, a teacher of political theory for many years, come to study and write about the most down-to-earth issue of neighborliness and democracy in daily life?
Bill, sometimes something happens and you're just startled into thought. And that's what happened to me. I lived in an apartment building where one of the neighbors put an air conditioner on the roof that vibrated and caused noise. And so his next door neighbor and the whole family was unable to sleep, and they were desperate. He refused to do anything about it. And so the other neighbors in the building sort of rallied around the tormented family, and we spoke out against the offender, and he was intransigent. And we finally decided that we would pool our resources and we would pay to have this air conditioner moved so that our neighbors could sleep at night. That is, we wanted to resist this petty despotism. And that's what sparked my interest, because I realized we were doing something that was democratic, but that was altogether unlike the formal democracy of citizenship or even the sort of organized democracy that goes on in our civil associations, in our advocacy groups, and so on. Then I realized something else about why it is that this was such a powerful experience for me, and that's that neighbors, you can't avoid them. They're there. Proximity matters. And the proximity is a cause for arguments and slights and acts of aggression, and also, of course, for acts of generosity. So people tell their stories about neighbors, and I'm telling this one with enormous feeling. And that's because neighbors are not just proximate to us and unavoidable. It's also that our relations to neighbors take place around home. and we have a special depth and intensity of our interests at home. We expect privacy, we expect control, and yet retreat really is impossible. So here was a sort of sphere of life that really hadn't been written about much before that I thought was morally important, and that also had certain characteristics of democracy, at least neighborliness in the United States does. And I was interested in what that was, what those sort of political morality of neighbors was, and how it could go wrong.
Now, in recognizing that democratic sphere that got so little attention previous to, I think your book actually was eye-opening for lots of people, it received so little attention, and yet, of course, neighborliness is something that we learn and practice, at least many of us learn and practice, and it's not without neighborliness can actually fail and destructive tendencies take over. We'll be talking about that later. But neighborliness is a sort of a dominant practice for most people, except in really troubled neighborhoods. It seems to me that another reason, though, for talking about those practices of daily life, including neighborliness, and we'll get to another, some parenting and other things later in the interview, neighborliness is like, in some ways, a school, and it develops ideas and understandings that seems to me that become the predicate or the basis of actually a successful political democracy, which the U.S. may or may not become, one wonders nowadays. Is that part of your reasoning? Tell us about the relationship between neighborliness and then the political narrowly defined sphere.
I have an account of the elements of neighborliness. But before I get to it, let me just say that there are two common ways of thinking about neighbors in America. One is just the Old and New Testament injunction to love thy neighbor as thyself. And whatever you think of it, it's a very puzzling thing to imagine that you can love your neighbor as yourself. And the great progressive community organizer, Mary Parker Follett, you probably know about her, says, I'm ready to say to you, this minute I love my neighbors, but all that I mean by it is that I have a vague feeling of kindliness to them. And then she admits, I have no idea how to do the actual deed, how to love my neighbor. I shall offend against the law of love within the hour. So that's one way we think about neighbors, if we think about them at all, in this extremely inaccessible notion of loving them. And the other way is to see neighbors as a kind of school of democracy, that neighborly relations should be sort of organizing together to do something to fix a local problem. And that, too, is a progressive idea. I think Dewey said exactly that, John Dewey, that these were little schools of democracy. And I didn't find either of those really to describe my own experience of neighbors or all the reading that I had done about settlers in America and immigrant communities in America and contemporary neighbors. So I began to think about what are the values or what are the practices really that are signatures of neighbors as opposed to signatures of our lives in politics or our lives in organized associations. And I came up with two principal ones, and you'll see why I call them democratic, even though they don't correspond to political democracy. And one is that what we expect of neighbors is a certain kind of reciprocity. If you're live in a community of need, often the demands on reciprocity can be quite severe. You know, you need a ride to work or you'll lose your job or you need some money to get through the month. Sort of like settlers in the old days where reciprocity amongst neighbors really was a physical necessity. But for many of us, reciprocity is just saying, how are you today? And acknowledging greetings and so on and so forth. And what makes reciprocity democratic, besides the fact that it's a kind of give and take in the very local community, is that we tend, then there's a famous phrase for this, we tend to ask, what neighbors deserve our reciprocity? You know, why do we do it? And the answer is, we'll have reciprocity amongst a neighbor as long as they're sort of decent folk, as long as they don't ruin our lives or act intemperately or aggressively, as long as they're not actively hostile. And so we tend to ignore other kinds of things, an economic situation or religion or even ideally or aspirationally race. And so these things, the reciprocity and the fact that it's inclusive, at least if people aren't arrantly, wantonly aggressive attitude towards you is a kind of democratic interaction, a democratic value. It designates a certain kind of equality, but just equality in this one respect as a neighbor. It separates out the qualities of a neighbor from citizenship or social standing or national origin or whatever. So those are the elements, I think, of good neighborliness here. And it helps you to see when it is that neighborliness fails, when you really do encounter the other person solely in terms of their religion or their race, and not in terms of the special role that we have of being a neighbor.
Bill Resnick here for Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Nancy Rosenblum, who taught at Harvard School of Government, recently wrote the book Good Neighbors, A Democracy of Everyday Life. We've just discussed how neighborliness, we develop tolerance and listening skills and restraint that's necessary in a stable political democracy. Nancy Rosenblum, in your book and writings, you don't romanticize neighborliness or living in neighborhoods. Neighbors can, as in U.S. history, they can lynch their neighbors or send them to internment camps or economically exploit them using the force of law. Or, as in Nazi Germany or Stalin's Russia, and many other less terrible situations, neighbors can betray their neighbors. So what do you see as the conditions for what we see as neighborliness? What are the conditions for that type of neighborliness versus neighbors betraying one another and taking advantage of them?
That's a good question. So as you point out, Bill, I have a chapter on lynching, which was often done by people who knew one another or even lived beside one another. I have a chapter on the Japanese internment, where Japanese Americans, but also non-citizens, had lived side by side with white people for many, many years, sometimes for generations, and who, when they were interned, these neighbors not only turned their heads away and didn't protest, but they looted their houses, they took their property, they took over their farms, and the Japanese Americans were never recompensed, and those neighbors who did these things to them were never charged with anything. So they are extraordinary, and we know that, for example, in Stalinist Russia, the secret police used neighbors to inform one another, and even within families, people informed on one another. These are the dramatic degradations of neighborliness, and I think that they all have something in common, and it brings us to my worry about neighbors today. And what they have in common is that they have politicized and used neighbors against one another, so that the Japanese internment story is a story of the national government of the United States declaring that the Japanese on the West Coast, not the Germans, by the way, the Japanese on the West Coast were aliens or traitors or liable to be so, and they were dehumanized by writers, political commentators, by the military, by the Supreme Court. So there was a kind of radical, dramatic, and very quick transformation of these Japanese neighbors from people who were different, with you might or might not like them, you might have had struggles with them on the ordinary day-to-day basis, but who had become dehumanized and alien to you, and then you would feel free to, or many people would feel free to, exploit them and damage them. And the same thing is obviously true of lynching. That is, you had a regime after Reconstruction, all the way into the 1930s and 40s in the South, a legal regime of white supremacy and immunity, legal immunity to the most monstrous kinds of behavior towards blacks. These were situations that were created by and enforced by governments. Now, that's not to say that you would have had benign racial relations without it. Of course, you would not have, but you would not have had the kind of horror that you had with lynching or with Japanese internment and other examples. And let me go back and say that what I've discovered is that even in these most dramatic situations, there were neighbors who kept up the norms of reciprocity and of seeing these neighbors as decent folk. And there are wonderful stories that I also tell about neighbors who visited their Japanese former neighbors in internment camps, who took care of their property, who even worked their farms so that when they came back, they would come back to something. And the same thing is true amongst whites and blacks in the period, long period of racial violence and lynching in the South. So there is always a residue. It is never completely eliminated. But what this brings me to is my concern today, because what we've seen under Trump, but it went on for probably 20 years before that, of a gradual releasing of white supremacy and violence, and abetted by conspiracism and by the disruption of government, that has seeped down from the level of politics and the level of sort of organized groups for and against white supremacy and for and against Trump and so on into neighborhoods. So that you began to see, when Trump was elected, all kinds of stories and even some data on the way in which neighbors who had lived together reasonably amicably, according to the norms that I set out, who began to fear one another, who began to see one another as an enemy, who stopped talking to one another, who began to harass one another. And that has come to a head, I think, Bill, with COVID, where we see neighbors who are fearful of one another, who are disdainful of one another, who are willing to give one another a deadly disease, and so on. And so, once again, it is the neighborly sphere, which has never been sacrosanct or completely cordoned off from society or government, but which had its own norms and relations that revolved around living next to one another indefinitely. And we see how vulnerable they are, how quickly they can be completely eclipsed by a radical and extremist and a very destructive politics.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick for Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, talking to Nancy Rosenblum. Taught in Harvard School of Government, recently wrote the book Good Neighbors, A Democracy of Everyday Life. We've just discussed how neighborhoods do not necessarily produce democracy. People can kill their neighbors or enslave them. And we discussed the social and economic conditions that lead to undemocratic and sometimes murderous action, and pointed out that action from the top, from leadership, had a lot to do with undermining neighborliness and leading to sometimes murderous outcomes. Nancy, right now this country is in great trouble, unable to respond to various crises, accelerating climate change, growing inequality, precariousness, corporate domination of government that's now paralyzed, unable to act, and as you pointed out now, COVID that's been disastrously handled and undermine people's confidence in government and public action. And finally, we have a deranged person with a vast following, many hostile to people of color and science and indeed democracy, unless it delivers, of course, what they want. Anyway, they and their great leader could take over this country, which is a fearsome thought. My sense is that this dismal story, though, is not the whole picture. So I'll leave you with the last word. What do you see as the way out of this dilemma? And how can we build this, capitalize on all the democratic impulses in everyday life, including neighborliness that still exists, to build movements which would change the way the economy operates and basically many areas of daily life in the United States, how we produce things and how we consume, and how can we build that democratic movement?
Bill, that's the question, isn't it? I think that we are building a democratic movement. I think that we often see organized resistance when times are the darkest. And I think that we're seeing that here. If you look at the last 5 years, there has been an enormous amount of mobilization against the worst. I think that Black Lives Matter at its height was one of the largest social movements in American history by numbers. The Women's March after Trump was inaugurated was, I believe, the largest march in the United States. So I think that we are seeing organized political advocacy group and organization and large-scale social movements. And what's most important is that these movements be translated into electoral power, into votes. And we see an effort at that like none I've ever seen in my lifetime, and that may not have existed before. So all of that makes me hopeful. Since we're talking about neighbors, the question is what the most local level and the people who live in your building have to do with this. And I think that it's important that some of the most important or critical political issues are local issues. Police violence is one. Climate change is actually a very local issue if you think about the adaptation that has to happen to make people able to live in a healthy way in this environment. And that's going to be very different, you know, in Palo Alto or in where you are than it is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or if you're in Florida. So I think that the very issues that are most critical today have become local issues, including COVID. The areas in which people will not get vaccinated and are spreading this disease to one another are local areas. So localism has become very important. And while neighbors per se don't organize, one neighbor who joins an advocacy group and has a march against police violence in the area recruits other neighbors. That's how you get people into these organizations and mobilize them. You invite them and you invite people you live with, live near and by. So I think that there is both a democratic mobilization and that it extends to the local level. And that makes me hopeful. And the last thing I'll just say about this is that I think that Biden's plans, and it depends, of course, on him being successful, getting them legislatively passed and implemented, to the extent that they show people that the national government matters, that it can deliver things to them that really they desperately need and that they can get efficiently and in a reasonably fair way, having positive expectations from government will help democratic mobilization as well.
Nancy Rosenblum, thanks so much for talking to us today. Yes, there are hopeful signs, and there are very troubling signs. Only, I guess, in our daily actions will history be made. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Bill.
That was Bill Resnick and Nancy Rosenblum on Everyday Democracy. We turn now to book mole Larry Bolden. Today, Larry reviews the novel Take What You Can Carry by Jian Sadar. Since the moles are still producing our show remotely, I'm going to be reading Larry's review for him. It's 1979, and Olivia Murray, who is a secretary at a Los Angeles newspaper, has aspirations of becoming a photojournalist. Out of the blue, she has a chance to go to Iraq with her Kurdish boyfriend, ostensibly for the wedding of his cousin, but also because he needs to reunite with his family. And so begins this remarkable 2021 novel by Jian Sadar, Take What You Can Carry. In her acknowledgments at the end of the book, Sadar explains that, quote, Kurdistan is spread over four countries, so isolation has been both geographic as well as political, end quote. While Sadar is quick to point out that her book is a work of fiction, it's based on true events. Sadar's father is from Kurdistan, and her mother is a U.S. citizen. She explains that her father's tales about his life in Kurdistan provide the kernel of the story she tells in the novel. Quote, growing up in Kurdistan of Iraq, my father and his family endured atrocities I could never fully capture with words. End quote. In many ways, this novel is a love story. Olivia and her Kurdish boyfriend, Daylan, find their love and their very lives in danger. Daylan has called his parents in Iraq to tell them he might show up for the wedding, but they must speak in code since the family is political and they know the government taps their phones. He is not sure from their coded conversation whether his mother is telling him to come, that it is relatively safe, or whether instead she is telling him not to come, that the risks are too great. Even before his trip to Iraq, Daylan agitates in the U.S. to inform his friends of the plight of the Kurds in Iraq. Quote, the United States and Kissinger had encouraged and funded them in a rise against the Iraqi government as a favor to the Shah of Iran, but abandoned them when they no longer served their purpose. They never wanted us to win. That's what the committee found. They wanted us only to fight and keep Baghdad busy. We were a pawn. Kurds quit their jobs, school, you name it. Everyone joined in to fight and to die in a battle we were never allowed to win. More than 200,000 refugees when they abandoned us, when we were being slaughtered, and not $1 of humanitarian aid from the United States. Our leader, Barzani, he begged Kissinger for the United States to help. End quote. There is a lot of drama in this novel, and I don't intend to give much of the plot away. Dalen has a brother, Saran, who is a passionate gardener and who says he must stay out of the fray since he has an adopted daughter, Leylan, to care for. At one point, Olivia questions Saran about his habit of bathing at night. He replies, quote, "People in our family, they've always been political. So even in peace, we had problems, arrests, imprisonments. But then the kingdom was toppled in 58 and the republic created. From then on, no Kurds had peace. And the government bombed during the day." He stops as if this is all that needs to be said, but then sees that's not the case. Imagine not having clothes on when the sirens go off, or when the ground starts to shake and you have to run. Imagine soap in your hair when you see the shadow of the plane. We learned to live at night, to work, to bathe. When the time came, you had to run. Take what you can carry to the mountains. That is where we would go, the mountains, to be safe. End quote. Olivia learns to hear the common saying, head for the hills, in a new light. Juxtaposed with the harrowing arrests and raids and constant fear, Sadar manages also to describe the colors and sounds and smells of Iraq and to understand the history of that ancient land. She describes the vibrant colors of the dresses at the wedding they attend, so different than the bland whites of American weddings. Quote, "In the field, she catches a flash of silver. The bride's sisters and friends are dancing with knives." "They're dancing with knives," she says to Dalen. He turns. "They're about to cut the cake. That's to let him know they can handle knives, that he should be good to their sister, that they will protect her." End quote. There is so much color and excitement in this novel, and while it is often sad and frightening, there are also moments of great beauty and courage. Dalen is known for his spontaneous kindness and generosity, which is often impulsive and even dangerous. But one of his acts of kindness turns out to save the family when there is an attack by government forces. This incident is one that Sadar explains is based on real events in her Kurdish father's life. This is a wonderful book, and I am so grateful that it fell into my hands. I was all set to review a different book, The Five Wounds by Kristen Valdez Quaid, but I read that book weeks ago, and it was already vanishing from memory. So I decided on this novel that I had just finished. I've been talking about Jeehan Sadar's 2021 novel, Take What You Can Carry. This is Patricia Kullberg, reading for Larry Bolden and for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was a clip from a song by Kurdish musician Mehmood Barazi. Next up, our well-read red Sharon Grant takes up the Olympics and Black Girl Magic. She shares an article about sport as a business and how Black women athletes in particular get the short end of the stick. The article by Kurt Streeter was published July 23 in the New York Times.
This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I enjoy sports. And yes, I do know that racism and sexism are involved in the majority of sports. But I also know there are always athletes who fight against them, and I enjoy watching young people grow through sport and sportsmanship. I'll be reading The Olympics Rely on But Don't Support Black Girl Magic by Kurt Streeter, an article printed in the New York Times. The article begins, Naomi Osaka, Simone Biles, and Gwen Berry are among the Black women athletes who will be counted on to provide standout performances in Tokyo, even as they fight to be respected. For better or worse, the Tokyo Olympics are finally here, and that means an extraordinary burden will fall again on the shoulders of a single group of athletes, Black women. Simone Biles is one of the most brilliant talents at the Games, but if recent history holds and she tries her most stunning moves in Tokyo, gymnastics officials will place an arbitrary limit on her score. Some say this is meant to discourage other competitors from attempting similarly dangerous aerial maneuvers. I say the sports regulators cannot deal with her sheer audacity. Naomi Osaka is a supernova, perhaps the most widely known female athlete on the planet not named Serena Williams. Osaka's idol, who astutely decided not to bother with the games. But Osaka will get tossed under the bus if she is not polite and pleasant in her interviews with the news media, a backlash prompted by her withdrawal from the French Open because she did not want to participate in news conferences there. That pressure exists alongside the dread that she'll be derided as either too Black or not Japanese enough if she does not win a gold medal. Gwen Berry is one of the most powerful hammer throwers in the world and one of the boldest athletes in protesting racism and injustice. But the Olympic overlords have made clear she'd better behave on the medal stand, or else. These games will have a split personality. They will lay bare the Olympics' greedy quest for billions of dollars in profits from sponsorships and television contracts that, in this case, have forced the event upon a Japanese public that wants them canceled amid a surge in coronavirus infections and state of emergency. They will provide heart-stopping, dramatic performances, although no fans will be able to watch in person. They will show something else, the structure that wraps around and organizes sports, particularly the Olympic movement, fails in supporting women, distinctly so for Black women. Despite not being properly scored for executing the most difficult moves, gymnast Simone Biles said she would continue doing them. When asked why, she retorted, "Because I can." Biles, Osaka, and Berry are not alone. When Alice Deering becomes the first Black British woman to compete in swimming, you won't see her wearing the newly created sole cap, explicitly designed to accommodate thicker, curlier hair. The International Swimming Federation banned it. And hovering over these games like ghosts will be several prominent Black women kept from competing. Who will watch the women's 100-meter dash without thinking about Sha'Carri Richardson, the American sprinter suspended from competing because of a violation of the harsh, unnecessary rules prohibiting marijuana use that are enforced by a power structure that barely includes Black voices? Who will watch the women's 800-meter race without thinking of Caster Semenya, who dominated while winning gold in that event at the 2012 and 2016 Olympics? She won't defend those titles in Tokyo because track officials have decreed that her body produces too much testosterone. Funny, nobody thought to ban swimmer Michael Phelps for his naturally occurring hyper and double extended joints, longer than average torso and wingspan, or powerful lung capacity. Phelps is white and American. He has clout in every way. Semenya is a Black woman from South Africa. She's treated with a lack of respect and a disregard for her humanity. She is hardly the only Black or brown woman discriminated against by a system whose lodestar is the Eurocentric, Swiss-based International Olympic Committee. The IOC swaddles the games in gauzy myth and claims to be politically neutral and divorced from the brutal truths of the world. But that's a lie. The games mirror society. The heavy burden Black women carry in all walks of life will be carried by Black female athletes competing in Tokyo. The expectation for many is that they perform perfectly and become headliners who sell the event. The expectation is also that they be ambassadors for their nations, even as they struggle for equality at home and respect from the federations, governing bodies, sponsors, and media who make up the rules and mores of their sports. The pressure will be intense. Outside of professional tennis, women's sports are never valued enough. That makes the Olympics, by default, the single greatest platform for their overall recognition. When the spotlight is not on female athletes, the fight is even harder. Away from the quadrennial glare, Allyson Felix, the African-American sprinter star, left Nike in disgust in 2019 when the shoe company offered a contract that cut her pay by 70% after she gave birth. The work never ends. In Tokyo, even as she bids to become the most decorated female track athlete in history, in Olympic history, Felix is leading an effort with her new sponsor, Athletica, to offer grant money for basic needs like childcare to Olympic athletes who are mothers. That responsibility shouldn't be on her. The phrase Black Girl Magic gets bandied about a great deal during the Olympics, but Black Girl Magic, as laudably comforting as that phrase seems, comes with its own cost. The pressure to be perfect thrust at women from every direction. Just ask Richardson. As the sprinter's imbroglio unfolded on social media, Amira Rose Davis, an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State, watched with a nuanced eye. Quote, "There was a short period where word got out that Sha'Carri failed a drug test, and in that period, before people knew it was marijuana, you could see how quickly her image changed, how quickly all the praise she'd been getting was thrown out, and she became this sort of disposable joke," Davis said. She continued, "Eventually, her cause became something you could trumpet, but before that, there was a window of time where you could see that individually, she was no longer useful as this symbol of Black girl magic. So that idea got tossed out. She became something you could throw away and forget about." Unquote. All athletes know how quickly they can be forgotten and dismissed, but Black women know this better than anyone else. In the Olympics, none of this is new. A through line connects the athletes of old to the athletes of today. In the American context, we can start with the track stars Louise Stokes and Tidje Pickett, who in 1932 became the first Black women to qualify for an Olympic team. On the trip to Los Angeles, where the games took place that year, they faced harassment from their own team members, including Mildred "Babe" Didrikson. Then, when the competition began, they watched from the sidelines with no explanation given for their exclusion. Chances are, this is the first time you've heard of their story. Who gets remembered and who gets forgotten? And yet, Black women press forward. At the Tokyo Games, they will show up and show out. That's not magic. It's work in the face of bitter reality. This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was our well-read red, Sharon Grant, about the Olympics and Black women athletes. Last week, I engaged the owner of a local photography shop to digitize a bunch of photographic prints for me. When I picked them up, he mentioned to me how interesting he'd found the photos, and in particular, how the photographer had managed to capture such raw emotion. He was talking about the old black and white photos by Betty Lee, who spent the last 30 years documenting Portland activists taking to the streets. 2 weeks ago, I sat down with Betty to talk about her work. Those of us on the left who live in resistance to a repressive and capitalist-controlled social order don't even have control over how our own movements are depicted in the corporate media. And all too often, stories are told about us or images are made of us that don't reflect our point of view. And it's just one more way that our voices are suppressed or distorted, or one more way that our history ends up being told by others, and often in the service of their own interests. But in Portland, we've been lucky enough to have political activist and photographer Betty Lee as one of our own documentarians. Betty has been capturing images of street actions and protests here locally for 3 decades. If you've ever been to a demonstration in Portland since around 1990, you might have seen her, the short, slight woman behind the camera who is always in the thick of things. And today I'm here with Betty to talk about her camera activism, what she's tried to capture with her images, and how her images have contributed to the local communities in resistance. For the next several months, the Moles are going to post one of Betty's photos every week on the KBOO website, but also on the Old Mole Facebook page, and we'll include reflections from Betty on her photos, and then we'll end up with an online photographic retrospective of 30 years in the streets of Portland through the lens of Betty Lee's camera. So welcome to KBOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Betty.
Thank you, Patsy, for such a wonderful introduction of my work. And I'm very happy to be on the Old Mole Variety Hour because Old Mole has been one of my favorite, if not my most favorite, KBOO program.
Oh, thank you for that endorsement. So Betty, you moved to Portland around 1990, and you've been snapping photos of street protests in Portland ever since then. You captured the protest against the murder of Mulugeta Sira by neo-Nazi skinheads, images of Occupy PDX, the various protests against the first Gulf War, and the Shell No, that wonderful and successful blockade of Shell Oil's icebreaker several years back. You captured images of the May Day police riot back in 2000, police riot against peaceful demonstrators. And most recently, you were taking photos of the more than 100 days of Black Lives Matter protests. Also, over the years, you've been a photographer for Portland Indie Media, the Portland Alliance. You've covered various events at the requests of activist organizations. But most of your work, I believe, has been just you showing up. And most of your focus has been on instances of civil disobedience or direct action or strikes and demonstrations. Tell us why you were particularly drawn to photographing those events, those kinds of events.
Wow, that's a pretty detailed history, what I've been doing for the last 30 years. Photography is a visual medium, so it's so much more interesting photographing people in action out in the streets than people sitting around and talking in a meeting in a controlled environment. There's just so much going on out in the streets during protests. It's like an ongoing drama, you know, like people bring their homemade protest signs, they wear t-shirts with funny messages on them. There are giant puppets, there's theater, there's singing, there's dancing. And so for me, it's just a visual feast. I also think that photography can offer us a visceral experience. There's just an incredible amount of energy and excitement and intensity when hundreds or even thousands of people gather out in the streets in protest.
Tell us what you were trying to capture in your images of people in the streets marching and demonstrating. What, for example, would set your images apart from the images that the corporate media would take?
I think that my approach to photography is very different from the corporate photojournalist because I'm personally involved in the struggle for justice. For me, it's a calling and a commitment. It's not a career. I'm not a professional photojournalist. I don't get paid for what I do. And I'm not going to win any Pulitzer Prizes.
You never know.
So I think what I bring in, which is in, reflected in my images, is a much deeper level of awareness and appreciation of the social and political issues that motivate us to go out into the streets. Also, I don't pretend to be objective. I chose to be on the side of the people over 30 years ago, and I'm not going to change.
I want to talk a little bit about what you think makes a compelling image. And to do that, what I would love for you to do is to describe for us that one image that you took of, they were actually two pro-war demonstrators for the Gulf War, I believe, who were carrying the flags and had their two kids. Could you describe that photo to us and then why you took it the way that you did? It's a very interesting photo.
In answer to your first question, what makes a compelling image? I think a compelling image, it has to carry a visual impact. It has to give you a visceral experience that makes you feel. It has to have emotional intensity. And if the image makes you think and inspires you to take action, then I would say that's a great image. As for your second question about the image that I took at a pro-war rally during the Gulf War in 1991. Ironically, it turned out to be an anti-war image, even though I took it at a pro-war rally. And what it shows are two men carrying two huge American flags that have completely covered their faces. There are also two young boys who are presumably their sons, are probably really bored and they're just goofing off and they've stuck their heads between their father's knees. So I think that this image is successful because it works on many levels. Aesthetically, you know, whenever you see images of American flags, and in this image, they're huge. So they're the main element in the image. American flags have an iconic power, which can evoke so many different emotions. And also aesthetically, you know, that's the juxtaposition between the headless fathers and the headless sons. And symbolically, it shows that nationalism is like a religion in America. It's such a powerful ideology that it obliterates critical and independent thinking. And it's often passed down from fathers to sons. And it compels mostly men to march off to war, to obey orders without question, and to fight and die in endless wars that many of them don't know much about. So for me, I thought that that image really captured a lot of these sort of meaningful issues about patriarchy, about nationalism, and about the use of nationalism to justify endless wars.
Well, it's a very striking image, and I believe it's also obvious in the image that the men are white.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe I should say white nationalism.
Well, there we go. What are the particular challenges that you faced trying to take photos during a direct action or a demonstration?
Well, street protests are incredibly unpredictable and things can change very quickly. So I got to react very quickly and take the photograph in a split second, otherwise I'll miss it. And obviously I cannot photograph everything and I cannot be everywhere. So I do miss a lot of shots. I think a lot of times it just comes down to luck, you know, being at the right place at the right time.
I was just going to say, I think you also sought out where the most intensity was in those demonstrations. You weren't shy.
Well, that was back in the day before I got much older. But you're right. I mean, back in the day, I would often go to the front lines because that's where the action is. But now it's just too risky for me.
Talk a little bit more about how your experience as a street photographer during demonstration has changed over time.
Well, like I mentioned, I'm much older. So I cannot outrun the cops anymore. If I do go to the front lines, I try to be there for as short a time as possible.
Has the nature of the demonstrations changed over time?
Oh, most definitely. I think that dissent and our protests have become increasingly criminalized at the same time that the police have become more and more militarized. And it's really frightening for me to be out at the protests, especially during the Black Lives Matter protests last year, because the police just pounded us, you know, with tear gas and pepper spray and stun grenades and rubber bullets and impact munitions. Many people were seriously injured. And I don't think we should accept that as the new normal, you know, because what it really means is that the state and the police are undermining our First Amendment rights to go out there and protest through intimidation and through, you know, increased risk of injury and arrest. And also, I think it's a backlash against the success of the Black Lives Matter movement last year.
I want to ask you one last question about your photography. I've heard you describe it as doing cultural work. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk a little bit about what that means and why it's important?
Well, I think that the common theme that runs through my work is the power of the people to create real social change. So we are the ones who are making history and creating change. So it's really crucial for us to tell our own stories from our point of view. We really can't rely on the corporate media. They're motivated by their own agenda or the corporate and official narratives. So we really need to control the narrative and be able to articulate what's in our hearts and minds and what we're fighting for and why. And I think that telling our own stories through culture that includes, you know, photography, the visual arts, writings, music, dance, theater, the independent media, all of that is so important. And I really hope that my images are a small contribution.
Oh, I think they have been. And again, as I look through the images, as I've been doing over the past couple of weeks, it's striking to me the continuities over time, some of the issues that we were fighting against or fighting for 3 decades ago are still with us now.
Yes.
That a lot of the issues that the demonstrations and the way you photograph them demonstrate the connections between a lot of those issues, that racist murders have a lot to do with wars in Iraq, have a lot to do with Shell oil destroying the environment, that these are all related issues. I think that comes through. And I think they're very inspiring. They help us reflect back on, as a movement, where we've been, and kind of take stock of things. And I just would like to say to you, Betty, on behalf of the activist community, I want to thank you for your incredibly generous contribution to documenting our history. We're going to be posting a photo with Betty's reflections on that particular photo every week on our KBOO and Facebook pages. And our listeners can go to the Old Mole Facebook page to view what'll be a growing collection of Betty's photos. You can contact Betty directly at leebetty, that's L-E-E-B-E-T-T-E, at gmail.com. Betty, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Patsy, for your support.
To see the photo that Betty and I discussed today, you can go to the Old Mole page at kboo.fm. That does it for our show today. I want to thank Moles Bill Resnick, Larry Bolden, and Sharon Grant for their contributions, John Nelson for his most excellent editing work, and as always, the hardworking staff of KBOO for all that they do. If you like what you hear on KBOO, please donate by going to kboo.fm. There's a great big red donate button in the upper right corner of the home page. Lastly, a very special thanks to our guests today, Nancy Rosenblum and Portland's own movement photographer, Betty Lee. Catch us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews of special interest to the folks on the left. Until then, stay safe and stay active.